You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My name is Gary W. Bickman, and I was born in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada, November 13th, 1943.
If you spend even 5 minutes with Gary Bickman, there's a good chance he'll have you laughing. He's a quick-witted 80-year-old with a fascinating history and inspirational life. I was privileged to interview him on his 80th birthday and hear 8 decades worth of funny stories and fascinating memories. He married his first wife, Susie, after falling in love at BYU. And together, they had 9 wonderful children. After tragically losing Susie to cancer, he married his now wife, Sheila, and inherited 4 more children. He spent his career continuing the business his father started, as well as participating in local politics. He's a devoted member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he'll tell you that his faith in God has carried him throughout his life. We'll begin his story with some early childhood memories.
One time when I was little, I can recall my mom telling me that about it later that I had gotten lost and wandered off and they couldn't find me. And they did find me at my dad's office shop. And I climbed into the cab of one of the trucks and had pretended to drive and had fallen asleep on the seat. And I was about probably 4 years old or something. My dad would usually come home for lunch because his office was only about 4 or 5 blocks away. And after lunch, we'd go out in the front yard and play catch before he had to go back to work and I had to head back to school. Good memories of that.
Growing up, both of Gary's parents worked very hard. Gary's father opened his own business, which eventually Gary was able to take over.
My dad dropped out of school when he was in 10th grade. This was in the 30s. When things were tight and his brother had started a little local delivery business in the city. And my dad dropped out to drive one of the little trucks for him. And they delivered things around the city, groceries from the wholesale grocery to the little grocery store. So he started working there after the war in 1945 or 46. Their brother-in-law joined my uncle and my dad to operate the business. And it started out as Speedy Delivery. Then it became known as Speedy Storage and Cartage. So they would have space in their warehouse to store goods for businesses, refrigerators and freezers and washing machines and stuff for furniture stores. And then they would move household goods. So if somebody was moving from one house to another house, they had trucks that they would use with a crew of men to load and unload, that kind of stuff. From there, they branched out into hauling over the highway when a steel fabricating company moved into the city. In Canada, the company that they formed became known as Horton Steelworks Limited. We began to haul the steel that they would shape in order to build steel water towers in cities like they used to have in small cities and towns, and oil field tankage for propane and natural gas that they would keep in pressurized tanks at gas plants and oil refineries. And so we hauled all over Western Canada, particularly into central and northern Alberta, and branched out to haul industrial camp buildings. These are units that would go onto construction sites and remote locations where you'd put 6 component structures together to create a 40-man sleeping dormitory. And they put 3 or 4 of them together to put a cafeteria dining cooking facility together on site. And so some of the camps might have 100 or 200 buildings that we would have hauled it, and they would have been set up at a major construction site. And it included hauling these camp structures all the way to the North Slope of Alaska when the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was being built. And so that was how we built our business. My mother got in the mid-30s to the LDS Business College in Salt Lake City and studied accounting, bookkeeping, and then she came back and worked in the city of Lethbridge. And in fact, that's how my mother and father met. My mother was an LDS member of the church, and my father's Jewish. and the family trucking company that he and his brother operated bought their fuel and parts at a local service station. My mother worked in the service station as a bookkeeper, and my dad would come there to fill up the truck with gas and would occasionally talk with my mother. And one day he was there with his nephew, who was shorter than the countertop. And he had come in, and my mother had just saw my dad come in, and he said to my nephew, invisible to my mom, "Do you want to go to the hockey game on Friday night?" My mother looked up and said, "Sure." So that's how they accidentally had their first date. And from there, it blossomed into a relationship that ended in them getting married. Mother and dad got married November 7th, 1942. I was born on November 13th, 1943. But my friends would tease me and say, "So your parents got married November 7th and you were born on the 13th. So they had to get married in a hurry, didn't they?" My sister was born 5.5 years after me. Her name is Deborah. And then my brother Shane was born 5 years after her. So obviously, we weren't close growing up in terms of doing things together outside of the home, but we were a very loving family. And my mom did her best to have us do family prayer and family home evening and go to church together and participate in church activities and make sure that we were a cohesive group. And my father's Jewish. He was a good man. He would donate to the church and help with building funds and things like that. At the same time, of course, he would donate to the Jewish fundraising efforts. And there was a synagogue in Lethbridge, and he wouldn't go to it very often, but he would go on occasion. And when I was growing up, he would encourage me to go to church with my mom and make sure that I did. And I can remember one time saying to him, "Well, how come I have to go if you don't go?" And he said, "I want you to be better than me." And of course, there's a message there for all of us too. I didn't grow up knowing lots about the Jewish religion, but a little bit, because my grandmother and grandfather, were faithful Jews, again, casual in attendance, but tried to keep a kosher kitchen. In my grandmother's case, she had two sets of dishes and did some great cooking of some great Jewish dishes, some of which my mother learned to make and became favorites in her family. And my mother, Irma, and her maiden name was Rasmussen. Her mother was McBride, and her grandfather, Heber Robert McBride, was one of the people who crossed the plains in the William Martin handcart companies. And there's a painting of him sitting beside his dead father, frozen on the ground beside their wagon when he was just a young boy. And he ended up immigrating to Canada, and my grandmother was one of his children. I'm very proud of my heritage, and I think that it's had an influence in me in a number of ways, one of which is it's made me more tolerant and accepting of other people and other beliefs. Cerning was 20 miles outside of Lethbridge, and Lethbridge had a bylaw bank in the early parts of the 1900s, 1920, 1930, so on, that no Latter-day Saint people could live within the town. They couldn't live within 20 miles of the city. And of course, Jews had some stigma. And because there was two golf courses in Lethbridge, one of them was the country club, very exclusive. And Jews were allowed to play there, but they couldn't join. And one of my friend's father was an executive of that golf club. And my mom said to me, "Gary, ask Mike, your friend Mike, to ask his dad why you couldn't join the country club." He said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "I'm told that Jews can't join." He said, "You got to be kidding me." So he talked to his dad, and it turns out his dad said to him, "Yeah, we need to change that rule." And so they changed it.
That wasn't an uncharacteristic thing for Gary's mom to do. He called her a bit of a rabble-rouser. She was very entrepreneurial and quite successful at everything she did.
She was very glamorous. She really dressed stylishly, and a lot of people modeled themselves after my mom. She worked for an accountant, and I can remember going up to her office where she worked above the club cigar store. It was only 4 or 5 blocks from where I lived, so I can remember pushing my brother in a little stroller and going up to see my mom and then going to a toy store a couple blocks away. And she found a women's fitness company that was selling franchises called Slenderama. And so they had some very slenderizing fitness type equipment. And then once that was going pretty well, she actually on her own helped two or three other women open up Slenderama salons in their cities, some as far as the Vancouver, British Columbia, 800 miles away. And then she sold that business. And while I was on my mission, she started a knitting shop called Carousel Knitting. It was in a building that my uncle owned. And right next to a business that one of my aunts ran, she had a beauty salon. And then my mother opened the knitting shop. It did very well. And my sister learned to knit. And my mom did fashion shows where for her customers, she'd have knitting classes. And then she'd put on a fashion show. My sister would model some of the fashions that she and my mother had knit for her. My mom needed a little bit of money to help start this. And I had an insurance policy that matured before I left on my mission. And it was $2,000. Which back then you could buy a Ford Mustang for. So she said, well, give me 50% ownership of the business. So I said, well, fine, of course, I'm on a mission. I don't need the money. So when I came back, the business had really taken off and done very well. There's some irony here. My sister had a closet full of hand-knit clothes. The value in 1966, which is when I came home, probably $5,000 or $10,000 of retail value and 40 pairs of shoes. Okay, a 16-year-old girl. So when I got home, my mom said, look, I want to own the business myself. I'll double your money. I'll give you $4,000 or $5,000 for the $2,000 you invested. So I said, great. So I used part of that to buy a nice 2-year-old convertible car that was a real babe magnet. And other return missionary friends and other guys, we used to hop in that and bomb out to a mountains resort called Waterton National Park and cruise around there and pick up lovely young girls and have a good time. But I asked my mom to make me a toque, you know, the woolen hat. She knit it for me. And then when she gave it to me, she said, that'll be $1. And I said, what? And she said, well, it's for the wool, just the wool. I didn't charge you for my labor, but you got to learn to pay your own way. And I said, Deborah has $10,000 of clothes in her closet. I'm going to pay $1 for my toque. So that's why I started saying to everybody, my sister was an only child. So she ended up selling that business, did really well. And she bought one of the first Mustangs when they came out in 1964 and a half. She was probably the second person in Lethbridge to have a Mustang. And then she got a Camaro and then an Audi. She liked nice cars. She had great taste. Then she went into real estate and became a real estate agent, selling real estate, and did very well at that. My mom had raised me to be so extra cautious. I'm embarrassed to say that I can't really swim because I grew up being told that if you just even get a few drops, as much as a spoonful of water in your nose, you could drown. She really overprotected me to the point that when I was in grade one, the teacher said that I wasn't being social, wasn't associating with very many of the other kids. And so she recommended that I see the school psychiatrist. So I went to see the school psychiatrist and afterwards, my mom told me, the psychiatrist told her, Mrs. Bickman, your son isn't playing with other kids because he's afraid he's going to get dirty. You told him to always stay clean and keep clean. In fact, he said to her, do you know what the first thing was? He said to me when he came into my office, oh, what a nice clean office you have. So that was me.
Gary spent his entire childhood in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. He has many fond memories from his growing up years there.
Lethbridge was a little city of about 20,000 people. I can remember growing up in basically one home, and it was about 8 blocks from school, so I was able to walk to and from school most days. There was a little Chinese grocery store about a third of the way there, and in the wintertime, when it was cold, we'd always go in there, and they had a floor register and stand there to get a little warm. And we'd go another 3 blocks to another little Chinese corner grocery store and warm up there before we continued on to school. We had a playground across the street from us. It was just basically a big field where we could run around and play catch and do things like that, play kind of touch footballs and so on. I was pretty skinny, pretty scrawny, but very coordinated, but just didn't have the confidence to go and play full bore in junior high and high school sports. But I played on local pickup teams, and I learned to dance. I remember taking dance lessons from some local Arthur Murray dance studio type liked music and learned to play the piano, but not very well. I didn't have the discipline to stick to it. I'd rather be outside playing catch with my friends. I enjoyed seminary and I enjoyed school and enjoyed challenging and enjoyed a little banter with my teachers. In fact, I can remember in a physics class in 10th grade, the teacher was demonstrating that electricity has mass, and he had some kind of a little device where you turn these two wheels and it would create static electricity, and there was round balls, and the electricity would zap across to the other ball. And to show that it had mass, he had one of the kids hold a blotter. Ink used to be, would run. And so a blotter would keep the ink from smearing. So he turned off the lights in this grade 10 physics class, and he's demonstrating electricity zapping. He said, put the blotter in there, zap. And he said, if you feel it, you know, it feels just like Braille. And I said, well, mister, what does it say? And he said, I don't know. I can't read Braille. But anyway, that kind of little bit flippant, a little smart alecky, right? I worked on this school, high school newspaper, writing, you know, sports news and that kind of thing. And I used to tell people afterwards, later on, that I'd been at a high school sports news. And I said, in fact, whenever I had to go into interview in the girls' locker room, I'd say, close your eyes, girls, I'm coming in. Which, of course, I didn't do, but that was my story.
Gary took that fantastic personality and headed to Provo, Utah to attend Brigham Young University.
In Canada, like, our grades were like 80 to 100 was an A, 65 to 79 was a B, 50 to 64 was a C, and then you had D, and then you, and then E for failing. And so, well, I got to BYU, I thought, if I'm getting 60s and 70s, I'm doing okay, but I was failing. And so my first semester, I had a lot of fun. I took 18 and a half credit hours, which was wacko, in civil engineering, which is what my dad told me I wanted to be. And I failed 10 hours. So I had to repeat. You know, then I was also compelled to take counseling class for underachievers. And so the first time that I went to the therapist counselor guy, he looked at my grades and he said to me, Gary, I wonder, have you ever considered doing something that requires physical dexterity instead of mental dexterity? But I learned the grading and I did better and repeated and got my GPA up to a 2 or 2.5. And I stayed to school in 2 years before my mission. My birthday's in November, so I was only 17 when I went to school. Back then, you had to be 19 to go on a mission. And I actually turned 20 about 2 or 3 weeks after I got into the mission field. So
Gary was called to serve a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Sweden.
It was a 2.5-year mission. You learned language on the job. And then my companion was really good. He was Elder Charrington, Paul Charrington from Springville, Utah. So he did a good job of teaching me. It took me a while to learn, though. I'd been there for 2 months, so 8 weeks, doing language study every morning for an hour. And we were sitting at a table in a restaurant. There was 4 young guys about our age sitting at the table next to us. And one of them said something. The other 3 burst out laughing. And I said, well, Elder Charrington, what was so funny? What did that guy say? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, come on, you speak perfect Swedish. He said, my Swedish is pretty good, but they're speaking Hungarian. I couldn't tell the difference after 8 weeks. But by the time I got home, I was able to take a Swedish 300 level class in Swedish literature. Whatever grade you got, you could get 12 additional hours of competency. So I got an A. They gave me 15 hours of A. So that gave my grade point average a very much needed bump, because that's a full semester of 4.0. One of the standard jokes for the Swedes to say to us foreigners was, did you enjoy summer? It was on a Thursday this year, because the summers were kind of short and the high humidity, cold northern climate, very cold and very penetrating. And it was physically demanding, lots of walking, lots of bicycle riding, no cars. You dressed as warm as you could, but you had to dress the mission standards, which meant we couldn't wear really warm hats. We had to wear fedora-type hats, and we could wear these little clip-on ear muffs that covered your ears, but they weren't buff in the fluffy way. They just kept the cold off of them. And we had to wear top coats. We couldn't wear warm muckluck-type boots, but it was cold. The high humidity the cold would penetrate and you felt like you'd never get warm. But people weren't generally interested in the gospel. But I learned as we would knock on doors and visit with people, people were friendly and they would be courteous and polite. I just remember noticing a feeling when I went into homes. So you'd see these, maybe an older couple had a nice home, nice things, pictures on their mantle and around their house of places they've been and things they'd done. But there was an emptiness. What I sensed and discovered later is because they hadn't had children, because it cost so much and they wanted a lifestyle as opposed to a family. And I learned very early that the people that were the happiest were the people who actually had children. The average baptisms per missionary per 2.5 years was 2. So not a lot of success. I, on the other hand, thanks to the way Elder Charrington trained me, for me, there were 13 or 14 baptisms. When I went on my mission in 1963, my mission president said, Elder Bickman, why are you on a mission? And I said, well, President Fletcher, if nobody joins a church except my father, I'll feel like my mission was successful. And then he looked me in the eye, and this is kind of emotional. But he said, Elder Bickman, I promise you, if you work hard and share the gospel with the Swedes, that your father will join the church before you go home. And 6 months later, he did. Pretty special. Met my beautiful wife, Susie, about first semester back from university. I was attending a special course that BYU was putting on for a young man and a young woman in each ward to teach them how to hold activities. They called it mixers, you know, and the man that was called was a mixed master and the woman was a mixed maid. So my friend was called to be a mixed master, but he couldn't go to the orientation. So I went. So I was there filling out the little form info on myself and filling out the little badge that said Gary Bickman. I think it stuck on my chest. And as I was filling out, I heard this kind of low, sexy voice behind me. And I looked around and here was this really cute blonde girl, face full of freckles, big blue eyes, really pretty blonde hair. And I remember as if it was yesterday, this beautiful corduroy jumper that turned out she and her mom had made for her. And it was just an inch or two above her knee. So I thought, whoa, I want to meet this girl. So they gave us all a sheet to go and talk to people. You know, I'm Gary Bickman. Have you done this activity? Crow like a rooster, I'll crow, you crow. Or recite a line of your favorite poem. And then she would do the same. So one of them was do the do-si-do dance step, where you have to do the go around each other. So I went up to her. I said, I'm Gary Bickman from Canada. I'm Susie Clark from Caldwell, Idaho. Have you done this do-si-do dance one yet? She said, no, I haven't. I said, should we do that? She said, sure. So as we were doing it, I intentionally didn't go all the way around. So when we backed in, we backed our behind into each other. And I soon said to her, oh my gosh, you're fresh. We've only just met and already we're dancing cheek to cheek. Well, she burst out laughing and I was in love. Somebody that gets me and laughs at my jokes. So we started the date and then by January, we got engaged and got married the following August. An interesting experience while we were engaged. I had a car, so I would drive her and her roommates all around. We'd do lots of fun things together, but I was helping her. And the more I did for her, of course, the more stronger my love became. But she, in the meantime, was very gracious and appreciated all the kind things that I would do and the places we'd go and the things we'd do together. She thought it was lots of fun. But she would really be committed and then doubting, wavering, not so sure. Samora felt like it was a yo-yo. She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. So this was concerning to me, right? So I prayed, Heavenly Father, what can I do to help Susie know for sure that this is right? Because I knew, but I said to her, Susie, I love you and I love doing things for you. Said my roommates, fiancés and girlfriends, they type their term papers. They bring them dishes, casseroles or cakes that they've made or pies and they iron their shirts for them. I said, I could do all that stuff myself. I'm a good typist. I can do these things. I don't need you to do them for me, but I think you need to do them for me for yourself so that you can give a little service to me. And bless her heart, she recognized the truthfulness of that, and she began to do little acts of service and kindness for me, and then became solidly convinced that this was what she needed to do and never doubted ever again. Yeah, it was a very good experience. We love those we serve. We did in our missions, and we do in our private lives.
If you're looking for love advice, Gary's the one to turn to. He has 3 rules for figuring out if you're truly in love. And these rules have even helped him throughout his life.
A young friend of mine that I'd known before our missions, she went on a mission to Brazil. And when she came back, she started to date a man who was about 20 years her senior. His wife had died, and he had a son that was about 18, so not much younger than her. And they were getting serious, but she felt concerned about the age difference. So it just so happened that this man was Harold B. Lee's son-in-law. Harold B. Lee's daughter had died. And so he said, would you like to talk to President Lee? I think maybe at that time he was president of the Quorum of the 12, about your concerns. And so she did. She and I were in a psychology class together. And so she told me about this experience. And so President Lee had said to her, there need to be 2 things, especially for young people, need to be physically attracted to each other. There needs to be that strong desire for the oneness that's reserved for marriage. And secondly, you need to have a testimony of the rightness of your relationship. You need to know that God approves. He explained, because it doesn't matter how handsome he is or how beautiful she is, there could come a time in your relationship when you're not as attracted to him, or he's lost his hair, or whatever, or for some financial problems or differences of opinion. Winds of adversity will blow on your relationship, and don't let it blow it down. So if you've got a testimony, then it doesn't matter what else happens, you know it's right. And so she shared this with another very bright LDS scholar, Truman Madsen. And he said, President Lee gave you good advice. He said, but there's one more thing. Because of your relationship with this other person, it should make you feel like you need to be your best to be worthy of him. You need to be your best self to be worthy of him. So those are the 3 things that I have developed into a little fireside presentation to you, and that I taught to my seminary students when I was a seminary teacher on February 14th. I want to teach you about true love.
Eventually, both Gary and Susie graduated from BYU and headed back to Lethbridge.
Well, I graduated in 1968, came back to work for my dad. My dad was very committed to me. I was interested in the business. I had worked with the trucks, and I had gotten a truck driver's license so that I could drive our big trucks. The summer before my mission and the summer after my mission, I worked driving trucks. And then the summer before I got married, I worked driving trucks, hauling our loads all over Western Canada. I liked the business. I liked the equipment. And I loved studying and learning about equipment. I would work in the shop with the mechanics doing simple things that I could handle. So after Susie and I got married, we moved back to Southern Alberta, and we bought a little house from my uncle. It was a tiny little house, cost $8,000. There was 22 and a half by 40 and a story and a half. So not big. Our first son, Samuel, was born in January of 1969. So it was like two and a half years after we were married. And then in 1970, I went back to BYU to get my MBA. And so I went there for 2 years. And then when we came home, we had rented out our little house. So we sold it and then moved to Sterling, which was an LDS community, and bought a little old house out here for $13,000, but it was 30 by 30, 2-story. You know, it was big enough for our 9 kids, even though it only had 2 bathrooms. And during that period of time, our 2 major customers, Horton Steelworks and Prebuilt Industries, the one that built these camp buildings, both moved their facilities out of Lethbridge. And so we were scrambling to find work for our trucks. And so we transitioned into the oil fields, specializing in moving drilling rigs, dismantling them, loading the component pieces on our equipment, and hauling them to the new location, and reassembling them so that a new well could be drilled. And that became our major business until about 2002. By that time, my dad had backed away. I had bought the company from my father in 1975. And then he hung around and would drop in and help me and resolve issues and tell me all the mistakes that I was making and how to do it better, do it right, be tougher with your people and that kind of thing.
Gary's business wasn't all that was keeping him busy. He was also very involved in local politics.
When we moved to Sterling in 1972, they weren't the latest approaches to governing and decision-making. And so I decided that I would run for mayor after I'd been here about, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 years. And I became the mayor, and we got some paving into town, and we got a very secure water supply, like raw water supply system from a reservoir that was fed straight from the Rocky Mountains. Up to that time, the quality of the water was not very good. When I became the mayor, I asked our local MLA to come to Sterling and to have a glass of water. And he looked at the water and said, no, but I'll get you a grant to improve your water. So we got $1.5 million grant, which, you know, in today's dollars might be like 15 or 20 million. So then we had a local engineer from the nearby town, LDS community of Raymond. He was a civil engineer, and he project managed it together with me. So we were able to do a lot of it with our own crew. So we were able to buy equipment and then hire the stuff that was too big for us to do ourselves. So we brought that $1.5 million project in at $1 million. So we banked $500,000. So it paid off all the village's debt that they had at that point, and we had money left over. So anyway, I was on village council for a couple of terms, and then I went back on council for a while when I remarried. And then later in 2012, so just 11 years ago, I ran to become an MLA. So that provincial congressman type approach. But I was an MLA for a short period of time and enjoyed that, enjoyed serving the people and doing what I could for our constituency. Well, then I've stayed involved as a member of the Constituency Association Board of Directors. So, and then I'm back on village council again, too. I enjoy being involved, and I'm just egotistical enough to think that my perspective could be just different enough that I'll be able to fill in some gaps in other people's experience, because we all bring things to the table. We all act rationally from our own point of view. So I think it's good to put those points of view together, find common ground, and see how we can create some synergy with different ideas. And I can remember driving down the street in Sterling, and I waved to somebody, and my son was sitting beside me. He said, "Who was that, Dad?" And I said, "I don't know, but they might vote."
Together, Gary and Susie had 9 amazing children. Tragically, and all too soon, Susie was diagnosed with cancer.
In fact, when she was diagnosed with cancer, it turned out that she was pregnant with our 10th. But because of the surgery and the chemo that she was going to have, the doctor recommended that the baby be terminated. And so after fasting and praying and consulting with our stake president, and I was a bishop at that time too, we concluded that was what needed to happen. So the surgery, cancerous lumps in one breast, lumps that weren't cancerous in the other. No sign of, they checked the lymph nodes, no cancer there. So the doctor felt like she was pretty safe and did prescribe chemo. But then she started to get pains in her back about 6 months later, and x-rays revealed that the breast cancer had metastasized to bony disease, and which can't really be treated successfully, but radiation and chemo extended her life so that she lived about 3.5 years after the cancer was diagnosed. Tough times to see her go down and then rally a little bit after treatment, then go down further and rally a bit, but never ever rallying back up to be fully healthy. So the last few months of her life, a lot of pain. She did not want to be in the hospital. So we kept her at home. She was, you know, able to walk slowly with a walker or whatever help she needed. We had hired her second cousin to come and work with us, and her mom came from Utah to spend time with her. My parents and neighbors and friends would help too. But the last 2 months, she was basically couldn't get out of bed. So the last couple of weeks of her life, 3 weeks, she was pretty much in a medically induced coma. But she was at home, and the kids could come home from school. They could come to her bedside, hold her hand, and talk to her, even though she couldn't respond. And that helped prepare them for what they could see was inevitable. Fasting, prayers, blessings, statewide fast. I mean, she was loved. And even a blessing from a visiting general authority who had come to a state conference. But she and I both on our own concluded, obviously, that she wasn't going to recover in spite of the prayers and the blessings. So we never said to God, why us? We needed to know what we needed to learn from this. And so individually, I left her at her bed, and she prayed, and I went another room and prayed for some clarity. And when I came back to visit with her, we shared our individual experiences, and the answer we got was almost word for word identical. The Lord seemed to ask us as we prayed for understanding, what's the most important thing to you? And of course, we each said, our family. We want our family to stay faithful. And the Lord said, and that will happen with Susie on this side of the veil, loving them towards her because they love her so much. And you, Gary, on this side of the veil, on your side, keeping them covering between the lines, reminding them of what they need to do to be worthy to live with their mom again. Because we had no know where she was going because she was perfect. So we had had indications that the end was near 3 or 4 times that she'd have these grand mal seizures. So it was just horrible to see her in that pain. The morning she died, I'd been up late with her and sitting with her, and I was in bed, and my mother-in-law, Susie's mom, sent one of the kids up, go get your dad. Your mom is going to die. And so the kids came and said, Grandma says mom's dying. So I just immediately fell to my knees and prayed that she would be spared any more pain. By the time I got down there, she was gone. So that was hard, but relief, obviously. My one son that was at Rich College, we called him home so he could be there to give her a kiss goodbye. And we said a family prayer. I said, now, mom did not want you to ever use her suffering and death as any excuse for not being your best self, for doing your best in school and doing your best in whatever you were doing. So we said, now you go off to school. We had breakfast and went to school. The kids went to school. And that's the way it was. This is funny but tender. My dad had been building a garbage bin for us that was about 6 feet long by 3 feet deep by about 4 feet high. And he had delivered that out there that morning to help us, you know, manage our trash. But when the kids came home from school, one of the little girls saw that there and said, is that where mommy is now? And they thought it was like a casket, not knowing what a casket would look like. But thinking that we'd build a casket for her while they were in school. Sam, the oldest, was in Brazil on his mission when his mom died. He had known that he wasn't going to see her again. In fact, before he left on his mission, we weren't going to drive down to Salt Lake to see him fly off because you could do that back then, but that we hadn't planned to do that. But Susie had just decided the day before that he was scheduled to fly off that we needed to go. So Susie and I, 3 or 4 of the kids, bombed down there and stayed at a hotel just right by the airport. So we were there at 6 o'clock in the morning when Sam was ready to fly off. So he got to see his mom one last time.
In the wake of such a horrible loss, Gary learned of a wonderful woman who would later become his second wife.
One of Susie's best friends, Debbie, had another good friend in Lethbridge. So she said to Debbie, when Gary realizes he can't raise 9 children on his own, or when he runs out of casseroles in the freezer, tell him to give me a call because there's a woman here with 4 kids who's fair people, devout, sweet, beautiful. He might want to meet her. So I waited about 3 weeks and I thought, oh, I can't be alone. And I prayed and kind of got the go ahead to start looking. And so I met Sheila. We went for dinner, went to an art show. She's an artist by training, by education. And it just happened fairly quickly. I dated a couple of other women in the interim, but it just felt like she was the one. And then when I applied those 3 points of how to tell true love or love with eternal potential, I got my answer and proposed. And she was just nearsighted and desperate enough that she said yes. Fortunately, I had a testimony, and I believe that Sheila did too. But Sheila had faced some challenges. Her first husband had left her with 4 children. Her father had died when she was very young. And so she had been raised in foster homes, and her and her siblings were split up. She was a convert to the church, joined when she was in high school at one of her foster parents, who themselves were converts. Very strong testimony, very faithful, recognized that God saw her through all of her struggles and trials. But she didn't have a history in these formative years of unconditional love. It took her time to really accept the fact that I wasn't going anywhere. And I told her that, look, it doesn't matter what you say or do to me. It's not getting through, because although I value your opinion, it doesn't count as much as God's opinion. And that helped us get through the tough times. But she was very organized, chore charts and family council on Sunday evenings to review the chores from the previous week, review the menus. And then, of course, family home evening and this kind of thing. She was very supportive of, and I'm sure I wasn't the easiest guy to get along with, because I can be sarcastic. And of course, sarcasm can be very cutting and cruel and judgmental. And I still have to bite my tongue often. And I don't probably bite it often enough even now. But nevertheless, she's stuck with me and I've stuck with her. And it goes a good life. And she's patient, organized. She loves me and loves our children. She loves other people and has friends who are deeply loyal to her. And she's kind and serves whenever she can. I say I have 13 children. In fact, when I was campaigning, you know, and traveling around, the people know I was from Sterling, and the history of the background of Sterling. And so I'd say, Gary Bickman, from Sterling, I have 13 children. I'd say, oh, relax. I did it the Mormon way. 2 wives. Well, I quickly had to correct myself, of course. That was just sort of an icebreaker.
Firstborn is Sam, born January of 1969, named him after his great-grandpa, Sam, who was born in Russia and immigrated to Canada. He was an eager, bright boy, quick to learn and eager to be challenged. Had a very good memory, and I had to be careful what I said because he would repeat me word for word. So next came Jeremy. He's our only child that was born in the USA. He was born in Provo when we returned to go to MBA school. But Jeremy was born a healthy boy, and we were delighted. Susie's mom lived in Salt Lake, and so she was able to come and help Susie with the new baby and help with Sam, because, of course, I was going to school every day, right? So we were delighted with Jeremy, and he was a joy as a child growing up. And he and his brother Sam were a little competitive, and Sam was dominant, but nevertheless, they figured each other out in the relationship. And one humorous exchange that Grandma Clark, Susie's mother, heard. She said, I just heard Sam say something insulting to Jeremy, and Jeremy retorted, and he was 2 years younger, right? Whatever you say I am, you are. And so that was Jeremy's rebuttal. And so for an 8-year-old or whatever he was, and we knew he weren't going to have to worry. He'd be his own man and do his own thing. Next came Joel, first child born in Sterling. He came along and healthy and strong, delightful, and enjoyed jokes and humor and kind of a little
bit of a chip off of my block, I suppose, in that regard, and very articulate, very faithful, and just was a joy. There was something always special. And he and his mom had a unique bond. I can remember her staying up late when he was in high school. He was going to run for some high school office, and she was helping him with his campaign and stayed up late helping him with posters or something. So they were particularly close to one another. Next came Jonathan, and another delightful boy. Jonathan was eager to please. He had a little mucus cleft palate, so he had a little bit of speech therapy when he was younger, but of course overcame it, and his pattern of speech was kind of Southern in a way. And so it delighted everybody. It was quick and happy, quick to smile, and made friends very easily. And he is the son who moved back to Canada after his university, and we opened up a Chinese restaurant together. We called it Chopsticks. The food was super good, but the location wasn't appropriate for a quick serve. And so he put in 2.5 or 3 strong years there trying to make it work, and then went on to other things when we couldn't make it succeed. But he certainly gave it all he had. Our next child was Emily. We were delighted to have a little girl, thrilled. And of course, finally get to use the name that we had picked for a girl. And Emily it was. And she, of course, was a joy. And her brothers were pretty thrilled and excited. A funny thing associated with that is that we were re-siding the house when we added on. They had the siding peeled off because we were going to put on new siding. And when we told to our friends who were doing the renovations and addition that Susie had given birth to a girl, why, on the side of the house, they wrote, "It's a girl," in big black letters. And the older couple across the street looked over and thought, "Oh no, somebody's vandalized Gary's house." But anyway, she could hold her own with her brothers and was just really friendly. She loved to read, as all our children do. And she majored in English and actually worked for an ad agency. Supergirl, just delightful. We love her to bits. Following Emily came Benjamin, our fifth son. Very popular, loved athletics. I promised him that if he could stuff the ball in basketball when he was in high school, I'd buy him a Porsche. He really, really, really tried. Didn't quite make it, but he was a very good player. Very creative and loved to make videos and recordings with his friends. But had a loyal group of friends that just kind of hung out at our place. In fact, they hung out so often that they knew where all the groceries are. So when I'd come home and back the car into the garage and start unloading the groceries, they would join right in unloading and putting the stuff away. He's focused his career on metabolism and insulin resistance, and he's written one book called Why We Get Sick. He's a professor at BYU, travels all around the world. Katie is a sweet little blonde. Very talented, once again, loves to read, and she is a writer, and she's a published writer. She's written several books that have been Amazon kind of bestsellers within that age group. They're really clever, really well written. We love the books, and we're proud of her and her accomplishments. She has 4 children. She and her husband tried for 10 years and couldn't have any. And then they adopted 2 children, you know, fairly close in age to one another. And then, miracle of miracles, she got pregnant and had 2 naturally. So pretty exciting. She had an experience with her mom helping when she and her husband were looking. They had put their information available to expectant moms who were putting their babies up for adoption. And this one mother, one expectant teenager, saw the information on Katie and her husband, Jeff. And she said to her dad, "There's something about these people. I think maybe they're the ones." And her father said, "She is the one. Her mother appeared to me in the temple and said, 'My daughter will love your baby, your granddaughter.'" And they looked enough alike that he recognized who Katie was, or what the connection was. So Katie and then Susanna came along, delightful, sweet, funny, cuddly, articulate, outspoken, strong personality. You know, her lost her mom when she was about five, but she never really got a chance to climb back on her mom's lap after her youngest sister was born. And so she really missed that kind of bonding that could or should have taken place. And so very hard for her. And she had neighbors and friends who were good friends with Susie, really went out of their way to make sure they heard about her mom and why they were such good friends and how they felt like their mom would want them to try and show love to her and pay extra attention to her. At least that's my memory of it. And Susanna left BYU to go to work for her brother Sam when Sam's wife Melissa developed chronic fatigue syndrome. So Susanna dropped out of school. So she went and lived at Sam's in Houston and helped raise the kids and help with the family, with the housework and that kind of stuff, and attended the student ward and met a young man from Honduras. They fell in love, and she has three beautiful children, very musically talented. Then Molly came along, and she was born probably about a year or a year and a half before her mom was diagnosed with cancer. So she didn't get all of the lap time probably that she might have wanted or needed, but she was strong enough to interact in a reasonably normal way until the last maybe 6 months of her life. So Molly got some time with her mom, and Molly has a very strong personality, very self-confident, a very aggressive, a go-getter. Lots of the guys that hung out in her little posse were kind of hoping that she would look twice at them, but they were just buddies. She was just lots of fun and bubbly and was a cheerleader in high school and had lots and lots of friends. Good student. She went away for her master's degree in Boston. Boston has a really great single adult ward, and that's where she met her husband, Chad. He was from Salt Lake. She was getting her master of social work, and Chad was getting a PhD in biomedical engineering. And they met and things clicked and they fell in love and married and have four children. And she's a practicing social worker, does therapy. And she would call me often when she was driving to and from work assignments or classes or things in Boston, be telling me with conference talk that she'd been listening to. And we'd talk about that, or we'd talk about life, the universe. She stayed close longer than the others. And I think, I'm not sure I can explain it, but it was probably a need, and it met a need with me too. So then from Sheila's contribution to our tribe, her oldest son, Jeremy, with an A rather than J-E-R-E. He is J-E-R-A-M-Y. And Jeremy was, I think, maybe 17 or 18 when his mom and I got married. She kept her home in Lethbridge, and Jeremy lived in it for a year, and then he came and moved in to live with us in Sterling. He worked for us at Speedy with our trucking business, drove a pilot car, and he and the other Jeremy became friends. And then there's Jonah. Jonathan's twin, you know, in terms of birthdays, twins by different mothers. Jonah was delightful, very bright, kind of fit right in. He came and finished his last, I think, two or three years of high school in Sterling. And he was just one of the gang. Jonah is a dentist and has four kids, and they live in Oregon. Next, we have Jameson. Jamie was quite academic and ended up getting a PhD in linguistics, did his postdoc studies in France and other postdoc work in Pittsburgh. He went on his mission to a Hmong, H-M-O-N-G, speaking area of California. It was in the Fresno area. He had a companion there who was from Thailand. And so he and this companion hung out together when they came back to him, and he would go to some Hmong and Thai activities, and his friend introduced him to a girl from Thailand who had joined the church when she came to America. And so they fell in love, and They have three delightful children. We love his wife. She's very sweet. She also has a PhD and, anyway, highly educated. And then Sheila's youngest child was about the same age as Susanna. And her name is Jessica. And she's tall and athletic and played high school basketball and a very bright student also. She has four children. And she went back to university to get a master's degree in education. And now she's teaching school at West Yellowstone High School, at middle school. She married an athletic husband, a good-looking guy, and they're loving Yellowstone and then loving life. So couldn't be prouder of our family. They've all found their niche gospel-wise. They're all strong and active and have strong testimonies and are teaching our children how to work and how to pray. And our kids all married well. We couldn't have asked for better sons and daughters-in-law than what we've got. They've encouraged and supported their spouses and have been equally yoked. So feel so blessed.
I asked Gary to tell me a little bit about what life was like when his kids were living at home.
I was the breakfast maker Monday through Friday. I'd be up at 6, so they'd have porridge and toast and orange juice and vitamin. And the rule was breakfast was at 6:30. It was optional. If you wanted to eat before lunch, you had to be on time. So missed the prayer, missed the meal. And we gave all the kids alarm clocks. We taught them how to set their alarms from the youngest to the oldest. And the merged family, like when we blended, that's sort of when we started doing that. Molly was like 5 or so. Got her alarm clock, showed her how to set it. Knelt down with her, set her evening prayers. Set your alarm, show me you can do it. Yeah, you can do it. And we did that with her for a couple of weeks. I can do it myself now, Daddy, so fine. So she did it, but about a week or two later, she came down late. Tears, I forgot to set my alarm. Can I still eat? I'm starving. No, but I'll cover your porridge with saran wrap and put it in the fridge. And when you come home for lunch, you can warm it up. My rule of thumb is all kids need discipline and need to experience consequences of choices. And discipline to be effective needs to be certain, not severe. The boys growing up, we gave them a job of cleaning our office where my trucking company was, cleaning the office on Saturdays. On their way home, they would stop and do bridge jumping. One thing that we did with our girls, particularly the girls, we did it with the boys too, but we had, you know, obviously a big car, Suburban, to haul our own kids around. So they would have 3 or 4 friends, and they would pile in the Suburban, and it might be a sister and her friends too. And we'd go into Lethbridge to go to an indoor pool to go swimming, and then we'd always stop at McDonald's on the way home for fries. And we'd have the radio turned up loud singing 60s hits, which is what I wanted to listen to. And so the kids were singing along to Beach Boys stuff and that kind of stuff. And if it was nice weather, we'd have the windows rolled down and we'd be singing loud enough for passing cars to probably hear us. My mom and dad took me to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which is a really fun place. And we would stay at some little cabins just a block off the lake. And they had an amusement park there, kind of like a Coney Island type thing. So we had a lot of fun there. And then we kept that tradition up. When Susie and I got married, we started taking our kids there too. And soon after we started doing that with our children, Susie's mom and dad bought a place in Coeur d'Alene. And so we could then go and stay there at that place. And again, those kind of things. We did Disneyland. My parents had a winter home in Palm Springs. And so every other year we would drive down there and spend a week or 10 days in Palm Springs. And we'd go over to San Diego and go to Disneyland, well, Knott's Berry Farm and things like that.
Gary has 47 grandchildren, and he loves each one of them to bits. I asked him what's his favorite part about being a grandpa.
sharing perspectives when conversations come up about certain things, experiences from my mission or experiences with their dad's mom in the case of Susie's biological grandchildren. But just engaging, having fun.
But Gary said his absolute favorite part is telling grandpa jokes.
Why does a faucet go drip, drip, drip? Because it can't go.
With Gary's contagious laugh and positivity, it's almost hard to believe that he's faced the trials he has, one of which involved losing his business.
My company got into some challenges, and the big company that had bought in to help us grow ended up taking it over, and I basically lost everything. So we didn't have a lot to rely on, but we did a few other things to help us keep the wolf away from the door, and we managed to make ends meet. And I was a sessional instructor at the University of Lethbridge for maybe five semesters. I developed and taught a life skills and employability module for the introduction to trades course that the college would offer a couple of times a year.
Teaching at the college wasn't all the teaching that Gary did. He was an early morning seminary teacher for a total of 20 years. He's passionate about studying and sharing the gospel, especially with the youth. He's had many experiences which he's turned into lessons which he loves to share. He shared one with me in particular called The Armor of God.
My hobby has kind of been sharing my testimony, sharing the gospel, an experience that I had years and years ago when a friend had gotten excommunicated, and I prayed for understanding, prayed for him and his family, prayed for understanding how could this happen, and I couldn't get an answer. And I prayed, again, with sincerity for him, and I really was curious. I wanted to know how this could happen, but then I realized that I was praying out of curiosity, not out of an intent to act on the answer. And when I prayed with a sincere heart, with real intent, then I got a clear answer, as clear as you can hear me. He wasn't saying his morning and evening prayers. He wasn't studying his scriptures every day. And he wasn't keeping a journal where he would identify each day my hand in his life. In other words, he wasn't putting on the whole armor of God. And then these chilling words from the Lord, and neither are you. So changed my life. Then when I shared this with two really, really good friends, one of the friends said, "It's true, absolutely true. Here's two other things that I think are important." He said, "Daily acts of service and kindness, and daily physical exercise, where you exercise dominion over your physical body." And then the other friend said, "Daily association with people who support your standards, people who share your commitment to being honest and true." So those are the six things. My faith has always told me, and I've tried to share this with our children, the Lord will allow to come challenges, the overcoming of which will develop in them the strength and character spiritually and temporally to prepare them for eternal life with God and success in whatever next challenge comes along. Because God can see over the hill, through the woods, and across the river to what's waiting for you there. And He knows you're going to need this kind of strength that this challenge will help you have. And so that's been our approach. And another key to keeping my head about me is when things are right between you and God, nobody else's opinion counts. And if you can be confident in His love and you learn to respond, for the most part, quickly to promptings, then you're going to be all right. You can just about accept and deal with any challenge, including the loss of $6 million or the loss of a wife.
As previously mentioned, this episode was recorded on Gary's 80th birthday. He woke up that morning to a beautiful tribute written by his wife, Sheila. He read it to me, and I think it's the perfect way to sum up his 80 amazing years.
A tribute to Gary Bickman on his 80th birthday. Over the decades, you've made the world a better place. First, you've made your parents proud. Second, you've cared for your eternal companions. Third, you've raised up many worthy children. Fourth, your legacy is passed on to your grandchildren. Fifth, you've continued to guide your siblings. Sixth, you faithfully draw your strength from the Lord. Seventh, you strive to help your neighbor. Eighth, you take every opportunity to serve God and country. All of this times 10 and more. And to he who is loved by many, we are blessed to know you. Much love, Sheila. November 13, 2023. Thank you, Sheila. Touched my heart.
Gary's story is one that teaches positivity and hope. He's managed to do some incredible things, including providing for and raising his beautiful family. He's had a life full of love, laughs, and serving the Lord. A big thank you to Cheryl Bickman for purchasing this episode and to Gary for being interviewed. If there's someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website at hearingourheritage.com.